So what I do is I fly infrared drones primarily at night over disaster areas after a hurricane or a fire hits, and I look for people's pets, whether it be cats or dogs, and I also look for injured wildlife. And then either I or rescue crews will go in and rescue the animals after I spot the animals after these natural disasters.
Thron has so far rescued hundreds of stranded animals in various places in the US and Australia. Emergency services have allowed him to participate in rescue efforts after making sure that the drone works well to achieve its goal. A video has gone viral showing animals at a U.S. zoo enjoying their bath time becoming clean as a new pin. Keepers at Chicago's Brookfield Zoo washed the animals to celebrate International Bath Day. From anteaters to rhinos all got sprayed with a water hose. They seemed to love their bath time as it kept them cool in the summer heat. Zoo officials say the occasion is to honor ancient Greek scientist Archimedes, who made a discovery while in the bath. You might be pleased to know life is going back to normal as countries around the world are easing coronavirus restrictions. Disneyland in the French capital, Paris, is saying bonjour to visitors once again with all necessary precautions. Bet everyone missed that. The theme park reopened its doors to the public with limited tickets and an online reservation system. All visitors over 6 years old are required to wear face masks and to observe social distancing guidelines. New attractions, including a hotel and various car rides, are also available for guests. Disneyland Paris was shut for over 7 months due to rising COVID-19 infections. This is the first time since January 2020 that all the 6 Disney resorts are open.
Elders in an Indonesian town are rewarded with live chickens if they get vaccinated for COVID-19. Officials in a town of Sipanas launched the program after the vaccination campaign faced a low turnout from the public. Many have been reluctant to receive a jab over various reasons. Some say they were afraid they would die if they get vaccinated. Now it seems that the rewards they take have worked well and more people are willing to get a shot. Officials in the Indonesian town say they go door to door to give the elderly jabs and chickens to show their appreciation.
Children have their own ways of remembering the dead. In Gaza, Palestinian kids fly kites in memory of their peers who lost their lives in the recent Israeli onslaught. Dozens of kids participated in the event, holding kites bearing the pictures of 66 little victims. According to the organizers, the goal was to send a message to people around the world that Palestinian kids have the right to live a free and happy life. The children said their dream is to fly in the sky without any restrictions or wars. A herd of wild Asian elephants in China has turned into international stars after leaving their natural habitat in Yunnan province. The herd of 15 elephants is said to have left home in southwest China 15 months ago, but it was in April when they grabbed officials' attention after they were spotted by locals. The elephants have so far trekked nearly 500 kilometers across the country. They have traveled through villages and towns and even stopped for a rest. Local authorities have welcomed these mammoth travelers with treats of sweet corn and bananas. They are monitoring the elephants' movements with drones while keeping them away from residential areas.
The Light is a short bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more every corner of the world.
Chinese grandma has given a dazzling display of her masterly kung fu performance at a martial arts competition. The 98-year-old woman and her son took the stage as a curtain raiser to the event. The duo put on a kung fu show before a large crowd of spectators who were impressed by her skillful gestures. She was invited to the competition to act as a judge.
I started practicing martial arts when I was only 5. I would box every day, learning movements like chopping, pushing palm, and thrusting palm. Though I am old now, my strength hasn't gone.
Zhang says she's inherited her family's martial arts. She's rumored to have a sense of justice from a very young age and try to help others, which earned her quite a reputation where she lives. Traditional martial arts have been passed down in the Zhongkang village located in Zhejiang province for 500 years. Go to Italy, where Mount Etna has put on an eye-catching show with its spectacular eruptions. Red-hot lava fountains and plumes of smoke spewed up into the sky. The main eruption was located at the southeastern crater of the volcano. Mount Etna is Europe's tallest active volcano. It's located above the Sicilian town of Catania. It often erupts but rarely causes damage. However, nearby residents have to deal with ash showers. Geological studies show that Mount Etna has been active for more than 2 million years now. Egypt has opened its first archaeological replica factory in an attempt to promote its culture worldwide. The factory was inaugurated in response to people's demand for having detailed copies of ancient treasures. So far, over 6,400 high-quality replicas of ancient Egyptian artifacts have been produced. More than 150 artists work to make the goods out of stone, wood, and even gold.
The materials with which these are made are high quality. The highest and most elegant materials are being used to make these samples, and the materials are very close to those used to make the original artifacts.
The models have certificates showing that they are identical copies of the original artifacts. Each replica also has a barcode that provides extra information about the item. The factory is located in Kayuba, about 35 kilometers northeast of the capital, Cairo. Now, a lot of people don't like rats and find them disgusting most of the time. However, the rodents are doing life-saving work in Cambodia. Now, the Southeast Asian nation has deployed a new squad of African giant pouched rats to sniff out old landmines. The new recruits have shown an exceptional ability at their task, with their handlers claiming 100% accuracy. There are now nearly 50 demining rats working in the field in Cambodia. The country started using the animal services in 2016, and they have helped detect and clear hundreds of landmines since. Last year, especially heroic rat called Magawa attracted global fame after receiving a gold medal for his work. The hero rat, who is now retired, detected over 71 landmines.
A muralist from Greece is blending mythology with graffiti and street art to depict how COVID-19 has impacted lives around the globe. Ficus Antonius has painted the walls of many cities around the globe. He is now in the Cypriot capital, Nicosia, to continue his work. His latest artwork depicts Americus, a Cypriot mythical figure who was punished by the gods and turned into a plant. The Greek artist believes this theme is similar to the situation people around the globe have experienced since the pandemic began. He explains many people have grown roots because they're staying in one place for so long. British artists have brought a combination of fun art and environmental concerns to the sidelines of the G7 summit. They have created a modern-day version of famous sculptor carved into America's Mount Rushmore. This time, it's called Mount Recyclemore. Joe Rush and Alex Rackage have made a sculpture of G7 leaders with electronic waste. They say their major goal is to raise awareness about the amount of unrecycled tech and gadgets, the damage they cause to the environment, and the ways to combat the issue internationally.
Well, what I'd like them to do, the leaders, the G7 conference, is I'd like them all to talk to each other and work out a plan that isn't just shifting the problem from one country to another, you know, but actually is a plan that we all work on together, which is how to deal with this waste and how to stop producing so much waste and how to recycle things. And all these issues have got to be dealt with globally. They can't be dealt with nationally because that's where the problem is. So we need them all to get together, like we put them together here, and deal with the problem.
The United Nations says 53 million tons of electronic waste are generated annually all over the world. It estimates that the amount of the waste will double in less than 30 years. If that happens, electronic waste would become the fastest growing waste stream in the world. Advanced robots are increasingly helping humans in a variety of innovative ways. Now they have found a place in the healthcare system and will help nurses and doctors stay safe during the COVID-19 pandemic.
I can do all kinds of things for elderly people. I can visit with people and brighten their day with social stimulation, entertain and help guide exercise, but also can do talk therapy, take bio readings and help healthcare providers assess their health and deliver treatments.
Grace, which is the newest humanoid robot to join the healthcare fleet. This intelligent machine can take temperatures and record other vital signs of patients. It has been designed in a way to also interact with the elderly and those isolated by the pandemic. Grace is a new prototype of celebrity humanoid robot, Sophia, created by a robotic team in Hong Kong.
So we designed Grace to look professional in a healthcare setting. So that would mean so that she would resemble the sort of human-like appearance of healthcare staff. And so then this would facilitate more natural interactions. A human-like appearance facilitates trust and facilitates a natural engagement because we're wired for human face-to-face interactions. That's just the way human beings are.
Hansen, a while standing between Sophia and Grace, also said that both robots could speak different languages. He said Grace's creation was aimed at relieving the burden of frontline hospital staff dealing with COVID-19 patients. The company is planning a mass production of Grace and offers them to the market by August. The cost of making this robot is similar to a luxury car, but the cost is likely to decrease once the company begins manufacturing it in its thousands.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
the limelight.
Senate Democrats are forging ahead on their expansive voting rights legislation with a key procedural vote scheduled for Tuesday, 22nd of June, as the issue comes down to one theme, unity. The article you're about to hear has been written by journalist Lisa Hagen, a politics reporter for U.S. News and World Report. The piece is titled, Democrats Forge Ahead with Voting Rights Bill in the Face of GOP Opposition. Stay with us for more of Lisa Hagen's article. Senate Democrats are forging ahead on their expansive voting rights legislation with a key procedural vote scheduled for Tuesday, 22nd of June, as the issue comes down to one theme, unity. After Senator Joe Manchin rejected the For the People Act and released his own proposal this week, Democrats are trying to lock down a unified front to show their commitment to a top agenda item even in the face of hardline opposition and an anticipated filibuster from the Republicans. The legislation, which proposes a long series of election, ethics, and government reforms, won't be able to clear the 60-vote threshold needed to overcome a GOP filibuster and advance. But Democrats are hoping to at least win over Senator Joe Manchin as the party's only holdout, aiming to stave off embarrassment on the issue that they've championed for the past 3 years, and instead focus the attention on a Republican-led impasse. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer of New York announced on Thursday that the upper chamber will take up the bill on Tuesday, 22nd of June. Democrats have amplified their calls for an elections overhaul in the wake of GOP-led legislatures seeking to pass dozens of bills that would place restrictions on voters, arguing that place the biggest burden on voters of color. The big lie is fueling these Republican voter suppression laws from one end of America to the other. The Democratic Party is the only party standing up for democracy right now, Chuck Schumer tweeted, referring to former President Donald Trump's false claims about the 2020 presidential election. Next week, the Senate will move forward on critical voting rights legislation. Over the next few days, Democrats will be working in overdrive to iron out a compromise with Joe Manchin to get him on board for Tuesday's vote. The West Virginia senator delivered a presentation on Thursday to colleagues about the components of his proposal, a meeting other Democratic senators described as positive and fruitful, though talks are ongoing. Senator Joe Manchin's counteroffer includes provisions like establishing Election Day as a public holiday, expanding early voting, and banning partisan gerrymandering. His proposed voter ID requirements, however, are likely to frustrate Democrats, but offer some leniency since a voter could provide a utility bill as a form of identification. The For the People Act, meanwhile, is more wide-ranging with measures on voter access, campaign finance, and ethics. The bill would institute automatic and same-day voter registration, limit removing voters from voter rolls, and create independent redistricting commissions to draw new district lines. All Democrats, including Joe Manchin, support another election bill named after the late Representative John Lewis, to restore parts of the Voting Rights Act of 1965. But House Speaker Nancy Pelosi of California said that particular bill won't be ready until the fall. We're really making headway to get all 50 Democrats on a voting rights bill, Democratic Senator Tim Kaine of Virginia told reporters on Capitol Hill after Thursday's meeting. There's the making there for a very, very substantive bill that can combine all 50 Democrats. Joe Manchin, the only Democrat not to co-sponsor the voting bill, announced his formal opposition to the legislation earlier this month, writing in an opinion editorial that he couldn't support a bill only backed by one party. His criticism highlighted the grim reality Democrats often face in a divided 50-50 Senate they barely control. Any one objector in the party can threaten the party's top priorities. His scaled-back counteroffer, however, ultimately didn't convert any Republicans, but garnered praise from some Democrats and voting rights activists, namely former Georgia gubernatorial nominee Stacey Abrams. Republicans are firmly opposed to both Democratic versions of voting reforms, likening them to a federal takeover of state-run elections. At a Thursday, 17th of June, press conference, they reaffirmed their opposition to any federal legislation, indicating that a filibuster on Tuesday is all but guaranteed. I actually think when Stacey Abrams immediately endorsed Senator Joe Manchin's proposal, GOP Senator Roy Blunt of Missouri said on Thursday, it became the Stacey Abrams substitute, not the Joe Manchin substitute.
The subcontinent.
Hello everyone, this is Mehdi and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. Our program aims to address important issues in the subcontinent which affect the governments, people, organizations, and the region as a whole. We will try to explain the issues, break down controversies surrounding them, and try to have some external perspectives from experts and people.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we are going to talk about the speculations over the future of Bangladesh's relations with the Israeli regime and its national repercussions. And we shall take a look at the efforts by the United States to establish greater military presence in Pakistan following the withdrawal from Afghanistan.
Recently, the Bangladeshi government made some seemingly bureaucratic modifications about Israel. It created such an outrage, or at least bafflement, that prompted the country's foreign ministry to reiterate that there is no change in travel policy towards Tel Aviv. However, given the recent developments inside the occupied territories, it might have been a test run to pilot the idea of formal diplomatic ties and see the feedback, because the wobbly new Israeli administration is in desperate need of a win.
A recent move by the Bangladeshi government to remove a clause from its electronic passports that barred its nationals from traveling to the Israeli-occupied territories has created uproar about the prospects of normalizing ties with the regime. Although Dhaka says nothing has changed in its stance or foreign policy about the Israeli regime, the controversial decision shocked the Muslim nation, especially because lately, Israel is under global condemnation for its recent war against the Palestinian people. Speculations over opening diplomatic ties with Israel have not been uncommon following a US-sponsored deal for Arab-Israeli normalization. Since the agreement, Washington and its allies have stepped up their efforts to force more and more countries to establish relations with the Israeli regime. The UAE, Bahrain, Morocco, and Sudan have already established diplomatic and economic relations, while reports suggest that some other Persian Gulf states, Saudi Arabia and even Pakistan, may be also weighing their options regarding formal ties.
Removing the Accept Israel clause from the e-passports came as a shocking betrayal to the nation, but was greatly welcomed by the Israeli regime, which used the opportunity to call for formal relations with the Muslim country. Bangladesh says its position has not changed, and Dhaka would never recognize Israel until Palestine established as an independent and sovereign country free of any occupation forces. So why did they move to facilitate relations? Why did they do it without telling people? And was the government hiding its ties from the nation?
Since Bangladesh's independence from Pakistan in 1971, the Muslim country has only recognized Palestine as a state, and the older Bangladeshi passports used to bear the sentence, "This passport is valid for all the countries of the world except Israel." In January last year, Bangladesh was among the first in South Asia and the 119th in the world to introduce the e-passport, a travel document with a small integrated circuit or chip embedded in the cover or pages. 6 months ago, when the South Asian country rolled out its new e-passport, the phrase was removed without any public announcement, and the information came to light only when Israeli officials started hailing Dhaka's move to lift the travel ban on Israel. Bangladesh's Home Minister Asaduzzaman Khan Kamal soon after acknowledged the change, saying that his government removed the words to ensure that the passports meet international standards. Foreign Minister A.K. Abdul Momen said, "The passport is just an identity and it doesn't reflect the foreign policy of a country." He said although Tel Aviv approached Dhaka for recognition and building bilateral ties on several occasions, Bangladesh's policy is still that of the father of the nation, Bangabandhu Sheikh Mujib. Bangladesh never recognizes Israel as long as Palestine is not established as a sovereign state free on any occupation army.
Now to have more insight, we are joined by Dr. Sabir Abu Maryam, Secretary General of Palestine Foundation of Pakistan. Welcome to the program, sir. And recently, Bangladesh has dropped the Accept Israel phrase from its passports, but the country's foreign ministry says there is no change in policy towards Tel Aviv. What's your take on this?
Thank you very much for this opportunity to talk with you regarding the issue of Bangladesh and Israel normalization. First of all, I would like to say that Bangladesh is a South Asian country. A majority have Muslim people, Muslim majority country, fourth Muslim majority country in the Islamic and Muslim world. In 1971, the Bangladesh has openly affirmed its position on pro-Palestinian cause. But still, their government, all of the successor governments of the Mujibur Rahman, they are following the same rules, same policy, which they adopted in 1971. Founding leader of Bangladesh, Sheikh Mujibur Rahman, had taken a strong pro-Palestine stance, which was followed by all the successors till now, Sheikh Hasina-led government. But such a sudden decision that came at time when Bangladesh is marking its golden jubilee, the 50 years of their country celebrations. This is a bad news. This is a very bad news for pro-Palestinian sector inside the Bangladesh. Especially they announced that the country passport will no longer bear the tax except Israel for the new passport printing. It is very bad news for the pro-Palestinian factors inside the Bangladesh, because you know that our Bangladeshi people, especially Muslims, they have their faith, they have their religious, they have their humanitarian and all of the aspects, they have relations with the oppressed people of Palestine, and especially they have some sentiments, religious sentiments regarding the Holy Al-Aqsa and Quds al-Sharif.
Now, what happens if Bangladesh starts formal diplomatic ties with the Israeli regime, and what would be the reaction of about 150 million Bangladeshi Muslims?
Yes. As I told you earlier in the question, that the Bangladesh is the fourth Muslim populated country. You are also saying that 150 million Muslims. Yes, I think that the Muslims of Bangladesh will not accept these kinds of developments and the decisions. And it will not be accepted by the Bangladeshi Muslims. They will resist against the government, and I think they must resist to against these kinds of decisions. As I have many friends in Bangladesh, and last night and today, I also spoke with them and discussed with them the same issue. And I tried to get their consent regarding the same subject. And I found that people of Bangladesh will never remain keep silent if the Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina-led government would be normalized with Israel. I think if Bangladesh will normalize with Israel, so maybe political instability began inside the country. As we know that the people of Bangladesh have their religious faith, have the humanitarian faith, and many other aspects and relations with the land of messenger Palestine, especially with the oppressed people of Palestine. And what is happening in Palestine, they are witnessing, they are observing everything. And we saw that in last 11 days war, recently war of 11 days between Palestinian resistance and Zionist regime, and the Bangladeshi people, the Muslims, they have supported Palestinian cause. They chanted the slogan in the streets. So I believe that Bangladesh, Muslims of Bangladesh, people of Bangladesh will never accept these kinds of decision, and they will must resist.
Could you tell us how can the West pressure Bangladesh into opening relations with Israel?
Yes, this is an interesting question. We know very well that the Western regimes, Western countries, and Western government, especially the U.S. and European governments, they always giving the opportunity to the monarchs, to the rulers of the Muslim and third world countries. They give them opportunities for how? They maybe United States and Western countries and Western government maybe give any opportunity to Bangladesh to trade with some European countries, some other, and maybe they can enhance this kind of trade which is already exists. And maybe United States guarantee to Sheikh Hasina that she will be more prime minister for next tenure. So these kind of things, I think they will pursue with Bangladesh by offering economic packages and other such things as than just the Bangladesh politics and intelligence agencies are already at the mercy of India. They are linked with Indian government, and India is a major enemy for Pakistan. So to can Western country through India put the pressure on Bangladesh, because Bangladesh has a good relations with India, and India is in the ties of United States and Israel at the same time. So in my opinion, the West maybe use Indian government as a tool to pressurize and to make the possible for Bangladesh to normalize with Zionist regime of Israel. The role of the Western world and India is also seen as an integral part of the process of changing words from Bangladeshi passport.
Now, do you think Bangladesh is going to normalize relations with Israel?
Yes, I think they are ready to normalize with Israel, but the people's stance is different. The government, the changing of the words from the past court of Bangladesh, it is the big and strongest proof that the government of Bangladesh is going slowly with normalization to Israel. But their hurdle is that the ideological boundaries would not allow them to do it. If they will do it, they will see the public awakening.
Thank you, Dr. Abu Mayyam, for your precious time. Now let's see how the people on social media see the situation.
Kiryu Ibd Kazuma has reiterated the official stance by the Bangladeshi government, but believes it can be the very first step toward Israeli normalization. Dr. Sanar Khan says dropping the phrase practically means lifting travel bans to the occupied territories, which means ignoring the Israeli atrocities against the Palestinians. Ali Masum has underlined the timing of the decision by Dhaka, noting that it is a step towards accepting the Israeli regime. This account has called the Bangladeshi government traitors because of their betrayal to the Palestinian people and cause.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
The United States is set to remove its military forces from Afghanistan, and the deadline is September 11th. So Washington is trying hard to find a safe foothold in the region and what seems more feasible than the nearby friend Pakistan. However, the Pakistani government has said it wouldn't allow the U.S. to establish military bases across the border in Pakistan after the troops withdraw.
According to an agreement signed between the United States and Taliban in Qatar's Doha, Washington should withdraw all American and NATO troops from Afghanistan. But to provide security for the U.S. interests and gather intelligence in Afghanistan, the U.S. needs to remain its forces close by. Pakistan seems a very plausible option, but there are many obstacles in the road. The Pakistani government is against any such ideas, and on the other hand, the hypothetical military bases would be so close to Afghanistan that Taliban would not accept it as leaving the country. Although many believe that Islamabad is unlikely to sign off on any U.S. strikes against the Taliban that are launched from a base in Pakistan, some believe Pakistan wants to allow U.S. access to a base if it can control how it is used.
The public opinion in Pakistan has been strongly against any renewed presence by the United States, and the government says it won't allow it. But there are many reported similar cases that the U.S. used bases in Pakistan and the government denied it. There is a sad joke that says the most common species of bird in Pakistan's sky is an American drone. And let's not forget that the U.S.-Taliban agreement happened because of Pakistan, without whose active support, Taliban leaders may have never even reached the negotiating table. Therefore, the initial rejection of U.S. bases may be part of Pakistan's bargaining strategy for more gains.
Pakistan has a history of covertly giving military bases to the U.S. giving the U.S. a military base in the southwestern Balochistan province will have far-reaching political, diplomatic, and security implications for Pakistan and the entire region. In the 1960s, Pakistan denied giving the Peshawar Bedarbar Air Base to the U.S. until Russia shot down a surveillance plane that took off from it. The government also denied access to the Shamsi Air Base until a U.S.-led clash killed 24 Pakistani soldiers in 2011, when Pakistan expelled U.S. forces. Agreeing can cause severe backlash from the people, who are highly antagonistic towards the American war in Afghanistan, but refusing may mean getting further from U.S. and further isolation. Such a move by Islamabad can lead to more pressure through multilateral institutions such as the International Monetary Fund and the Financial Action Task Force. Moreover, the U.S. may be able to use it to shift the blame of its failures in Afghanistan on Pakistan, which was among the most significant factors behind the U.S.-Taliban accord.
Now, to have more insight, we are joined by Sabina Siddiqui, foreign affairs journalist. Now, Mr. Siddiqui, the Pakistani government has said it wouldn't allow the U.S. to establish military bases across the border in Pakistan after the troops withdraw. Do you think Islamabad can resist such a demand if Washington insists on it?
It's like become a national security issue now, and the Taliban have threatened that any country that gives bases to the U.S. is going to be attacked by them and will be considered an enemy country as well. So consequently, Pakistan has categorically refused to give bases, and there's no more room left for that. No compromise is possible, as it is a national security matter for Pakistan itself now. However, Pakistan is actively engaged in the Afghan peace process, and negotiations are continuing, and Islamabad is trying its best to establish a successful peace process.
What happens if Imran Khan changes his decision and allows Washington to use Pakistan as a backup base when the American forces leave Afghanistan?
Well, the official statement has already been released. There's really no room left to change for the PM to change his mind, as the Taliban are openly threatening us, and not only us, I guess they are. It's an open threat for anybody, any country, any neighboring country which gives them a base. So there are very few choices left. Plus, you see, Pakistan is also trying to mediate in a way between the Afghan government and the Taliban, and the process is continuing right now. Let's hope for the best. Maybe we have a positive outcome from that.
Now, will Taliban agree to continue its deals with the U.S. in case Washington manages to set up military bases in Pakistan?
Well, now it depends more on how Washington deals with the matter, and I think they are doing their best. And I don't think civil war in the country suits the Taliban's interests or the Afghan government or even the U.S. So let's hope that better sense prevails, and no such thing happens. Otherwise, that would be total chaos in the region.
Taliban has recently announced that Turkish forces must withdraw their troops as part of the deal with the U.S. for pullout of foreign forces. What does this say about the future of the country?
Well, it's I have been reading tweets a lot on Twitter from both sides. The Turkish side seems quite hopeful, quite optimistic that they will be able to hold on after the U.S. forces leave, as they are saying that they have never been attacked by the Afghans before. And there are Afghan accounts on Twitter threatening the Turks directly. But one doesn't know if they are genuine IDs or whatever. So it's a very fluid situation. It's very unpredictable. Maybe they can pull it off. Let's hope the Afghan peace process is completed satisfactorily before the U.S. forces leave, and the situation should be calm, and there would be no such problem, I think. Then the mood will be better, and the Turkey seems to want a role. Maybe Istanbul is communicating with the Afghans behind the scenes. I don't think that can be ruled out either.
Now, will Islamabad eventually let the United States set up bases in Pakistani territory after their pullout from Afghanistan? And what does it mean for the U.S.-Pakistan relations?
Well, we have already refused. And as for the U.S.-Pak relations, our bilateral relations are there since decades. And it's not just about Afghanistan. We have viable ties in many other sectors and areas, such as trade. And then there is, if Pakistan has a certain geostrategic value, and I don't think Washington would ignore, but the ties will continue satisfactorily. There may be, it's already happened, we have refused, so that is done. And the ties are still intact, so I guess we have survived.
Thank you, Mrs. Siddiqui, for being on the program. Now let's see how the people have reacted on social media and cyberspace.
Asaf Bai has reflected the sentiments of the Pakistani people about the U.S. war in Afghanistan. Ahmed has criticized the use of assassinations drones from the Pakistani territory, asking the government to cooperate with other countries towards peace and not more wars. Abdullah Khan is of the opinion that allowing U.S. bases may have constructive consequences for Pakistan if the country can have some sort of control over its activities. Ali Awan is a firm believer that Islamabad will not eventually bow to U.S. pressure and host military bases in its territories.
And that was our episode on the speculations over the future of relations between Bangladesh and Israel, as well as the U.S. efforts to get Islamabad's go-ahead for military bases in Pakistan following the pullout from Afghanistan. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take care.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
John Bercow, the former Tory MP and Speaker of the House of Commons, has delivered an extraordinary broadside against Boris Johnson and the Conservative Party, as he announces he has switched his political allegiance to the Labour Party. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Observer's political editor, Toby Helm. The piece is titled, John Bercow Defects to Labour with Withering Attack on Johnson. Stay with us for more of Toby Helm's article. The former Tory MP and Speaker of the House of Commons has delivered an extraordinary broadside against Prime Minister Boris Johnson and the Conservative Party, as he announces he has switched his political allegiance to Labour. In an explosive interview with The Observer, John Bercow says he regards today's Conservative Party as, quote, reactionary, populist, nationalistic, and sometimes even xenophobic, unquote. Bercow, who stepped down as Speaker of the House of Commons in 2019 after 10 years, says he joined the Labour Party a few weeks ago because he now shares its values and sees it as the only means of removing the current Tory government from office. I'm motivated by support for equality, social justice, and internationalism. That is the Labour brand, he said. The conclusion I have reached is that this government needs to be replaced. The reality is that the Labour Party is the only vehicle that can achieve that objective. There is no other credible option. John Bercow says that despite Boris Johnson's professed commitment to levelling up, he has no interest in those less privileged than himself. He also described as utterly shameful the government's decision to cut international aid. He's a successful campaigner, but a lousy governor, he said. I don't think he has any vision of a more equitable society, any thirst for social mobility, or any passion to better the lot of people less fortunate than he is. I think increasingly people are sick of lies, sick of empty slogans, and sick of a failure to deliver. Number 10 Downing Street is likely to dismiss John Bercow's comments as those of an embittered Remainer out for revenge because he has not been offered a peerage, as is customary for a retired Speaker of the House of Commons. The news caps one of the most difficult weeks of Boris Johnson's premiership to date. It is also marks the latest stage in an extraordinary political odyssey for Bercow, who joined the Tory party at age 17 and describes himself as having once been a rabid right-winger. By the early 2000s, John Bercow had moved towards the more liberal, internationalist wing of the Conservative Party. In 2009, when he became Speaker of the House of Commons, convention dictated that he had to resign his party membership. The Tories' unexpected loss of the Chesham and Amersham parliamentary seat, where the Liberal Democrats overturned a majority of 16,000, has raised serious questions among Tory MPs and activists over whether Boris Johnson can appeal both to working-class voters behind the Red Wall and those in the more prosperous southern shires. The result has already prompted signs of a U-turn in government over proposed changes in planning rules, which critics say would have reduced the right of people to appeal against development decisions. The issue was one of several that hit the Tory vote in last Thursday's by-election in Chesham and Amersham. Referring to the by-election shock, John Bercow said he believed many traditional Tories were dismayed by the Johnson government's failure to match actions with words. He cited recent decisions to limit education catch-up funding and to cut international aid budget as examples of where its real priorities lay. I think what the by-election result tells us is that there is very considerable distrust on the part of the voters in the south of England of this government. I don't accept the thesis that this was just an anti-HS2 vote. I think that is very convenient for the government, but it suffers from the disadvantage of being wrong. I think people in very large numbers are disappointed, in some cases disgusted, by what this government has done. John Bercow, whose later period as Speaker was overshadowed by claims of bullying of staff, said he would not comment on confidential issues. In his time as Speaker of the House of Commons, John Bercow grew increasingly controversial and was detested by successive Tory prime ministers, people regarded his interventions over Brexit as self-aggrandizing and verging on bias. He reserved some of his most savage criticisms for the way the current government treats Parliament, suggesting that he believes it consistently hides the truth from MPs. I regard the government's treatment of Parliament as a disgrace. I believe the truth matters. I believe Parliament matters. And I believe that telling the truth in and to Parliament matters. There is growing extensive and incontrovertible evidence that the government is disrespecting Parliament, telling untruths to Parliament, and bypassing Parliament. And that is wrong, period. Some people may not immediately think that it matters, but it does. But it is a slow burn issue. Asked if he believed Labour could, under Keir Starmer, oust the Tories, John Bercow was unsure. The jury is out. I am, however, hopeful because I observe Keir Starmer at close quarters from the Speaker's chair. He may not be Bill Clinton or Barack Obama, but he's a decent, honourable and intelligent, and he came into politics as public service. I believe that Keir Starmer is motivated by an earnest and consuming desire to better the lot of the vast majority of the people of this country who do not enjoy the privileges that he does. Meanwhile, the Shadow Justice Minister, Carl Turner, said he was not surprised his friend had joined Labour, but was delighted that he has. John McDonnell, who was Shadow Chancellor under Jeremy Corbyn, said John Bercow had been scrupulously fair in his treatment of MPs, including the former Labour leader. He won our respect, especially for his fight to protect the rights of Parliament. I wholeheartedly welcome him into the Labour Party, John McDonnell said. On the Conservative side, however, Pensions Minister Guy Opperman said the situation was going from bad to worse for Keir Starmer, adding, Labour are welcome to Bercow. Bercow's wife, Sally, has long been a member of the Labour Party and was once a Labour candidate for Westminster Council. In a sign of greater cooperation between the Liberal Democrats and Labour, the leader of the Liberal Democrats, Ed Davey, gave a broad hint that his voters should back Labour in next month's Backley by-election. Political parties campaign where they can win, he told The Observer. We thought we could win in Chesham and Amersham. Labour didn't campaign very much. In Batley and Spen, we will have a presence. We've got councillors there. But we're not going to be able to, frankly, pour in the resources that we put into Chesham and Amersham. Voters are far smarter than people give them credit for. Liberal Democrat voters may well notice that this is a Labour-held seat, with the Tories in a close second. And they'll draw their own conclusions. But that shouldn't be stitched up in a back room by party leaders.
Economic divide.
Hello, welcome to Economic Divide. I'm Kavit Ahlaib. In today's program, we're going to take a look at crypto world, in particular Bitcoin. Why are central banks so worried about cryptocurrency as a whole? Some of the highlights of today's program, what is Bitcoin? We're going to define that for you. What is cryptocurrency? What is blockchain?